Texts, some very interesting texts indeed on the subject of Edith Fox. That's what we began our programme with. Edith Fox being Jane Costello's daughter, a small child who was with her in 1916 when she was killed. And John and Ruth Farnham emailed us to say, Edith Fox was paid a pension for working in the VEC in Bray. My wife paid her her pension. And Maria Burke King texts us, Edith Fox was a teacher in the Bray Technical College and taught me in the late 60s. She drove a black Morris Minor. Many a time she picked me up on the way to school when I was running late. I remember her as a woman who would take her job very seriously. So we are beginning to flesh out Edith Fox, who was a very, very small child during the 1916 rebellion and lost her mother.
The mission's primary goal has been achieved. We're looking at a large single cell, biological. We're looking at the first proof of life. Beyond Earth.
You're finally a daddy.
It's going to be a big custody battle over this one.
That's the trailer from the science fiction blockbuster Life, which is in cinemas now. It got us thinking about the history of man's search for extraterrestrial life. For as long as humans have existed and gaze upwards, the question has presumably been asked, are we alone in the universe? But it's really only in the last 60 years that technology has advanced to the stage where we've been able to start having a good look. As, for example, in 1977, when we sent a gold record on board the Voyager space probe with a selection of our Earth music, and this message from then UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
Interesting, the assumption that extraterrestrials would speak English and not German. That was the UN Secretary Kurt Waldheim, who was, of course, Austrian. We've asked author and science journalist John Duke to bring us a potted history of man's search for extraterrestrial life. John, you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thanks, Miles.
How far back does our search go? I mean, obviously, from time immemorial, people were looking up at the stars. They must have wondered.
Exactly, they did wonder. With recorded history, it certainly goes back as far as the ancient Greeks. And of course, that they are the foundation stone upon our Western civilization, upon which it has been built. They were definitely looking at it, and they were just able to philosophize, is there something out there? And then in the 16th century, you had Copernicus, which brought us the fact that the sun was at the center of our solar system and not the Earth. So then the idea became, well, if our Earth isn't at the center of things, maybe there's a lot of other planets that are similar to Earth out there that have life. And so it went on. And this, of course, impacted on religions, because religions have a very Earth-centered approach to the afterlife, if you like. So if ET is out there, how do we accommodate ET? But all of these things were kind of left parked until we get into the latter half of the 20th
century. So I suppose
century.
The fundamental, did Jesus come to save them too?
Exactly. I mean, you know, you hear the Catholic Church has talked about this. Will we baptize ET if he comes to Earth? Who knows? We'll have to find out if it happens. But in any case, in the latter half of the 20th century, with our technology advancing at a rapid rate, there were efforts to try and put science into this question.
Okay, and that centered around two young scientists at Cornell University. But there's a backdrop, and the backdrop is the number of an increased number of reported sightings of US UFOs, and that was particularly in the USA. What was that about? Was that about paranoia? Was it about wishful thinking? What was it about?
It's fascinating because it certainly starts after World War II, and I think there's a combination of things. If you're asking me, I've read a bit about that. It's paranoia, Cold War paranoia. Mm. Are these Russians, or what's going on in our skies? That was part of it. But also you had the CIA. Recently you've had articles in Newsweek where they've essentially admitted, look, we were testing strange craft around Area 52. The U-2s, which were flying over the Soviet Union. People were looking at these things, obviously. So, you know, part of it was paranoia. Part of it was military doing
technology.
Yeah, exactly.
OK, so tell us about Cornell University. Two young scientists there in 1959 searching for interstellar communications.
That's right. They produced a paper, and that was the name of it, as you just outlined there. These two physicists were called Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison. And they thought, look, let's have a look at this scientifically. What can we say? And they said, in terms of ET intelligent life, we can't determine if it's actually there or if it's not there at the moment. But if mankind has evolved, then it's likely that something has evolved on other planets, because there are so many other planets. They're in a similar position, close to a nice star that's going to keep them warm. And if they're out there, they may want to contact us. So then the next question was, how will they do that? And they thought, right, if I was an alien, how would I contact Earth? And they thought electromagnetic waves. Why those? Because they travel a very long distance, very fast, and they're not easily knocked off course. Then they got to another level.
So you can aim them.
You can aim them.
Right.
And they said they will also communicate in one particular frequency, which has to do with hydrogen, which is the most common element in the universe. So they narrowed it down. They said, look, that's what we should go look for first.
Okay, now that the ground rules then for finding alien communications had been established, what happens next?
Yeah, well, this Cocconi and Morrison paper inspired a lot of scientists to think about this and say, right, let's apply our science to this. One famous guy is Frank Drake. Some people may have heard of him. He set up SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Program, which is based in California. 1960 he set it up. He's still around. So he performed the very first experiment, SETI experiment, and he pointed a radio telescope because he thought it's going to be radio waves. They'll send us a radio signal because they travel far. And he pointed at two nearby stars. There were three nearby ones. He picked two to see if anything was being broadcast from them. He had a look and there was nothing.
But he did come up with an equation which is, I think, constantly being revised. He and Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer.
That's right. They put in what we know. So we know that there are a certain number of stars in our galaxy. There are a certain number of galaxies in the universe. There are a certain number of planets, which we now call exoplanets, that are close to the sun. He put all of these things in and tried to say, OK, how likely is it in the universe that there are so many civilizations? They came up with an answer that was somewhere between 1,000 and 1 billion. That's a lot of variability. And the problem was they didn't know, and we still don't know, how does life begin in the first place? But anyway, they came up with, if you're a pessimist, there are at least 1,000 intelligent civilizations out there.
But they ran into financial difficulty.
They did. And this has been constant. They were publicly funded in the beginning. There was a senator in the US. He was just one of many people of a similar ilk, William Proxmire. He was a very powerful guy, actually, in the 1970s. Mm. And he said, look, this is a complete waste of taxpayers' money. It's very silly, this nutty fantasy. These are the kind of quotes going off to try and look for little green men. And he killed off any SETI program at birth.
In extenuation, William Proxmire was a critic of the Vietnam War, holds the Senate record for votes and didn't accept campaign contributions.
Okay.
Spent $400 on his last two Senate campaigns. Anyway, he was obviously a skeptic, but from a scientific point of view, there was a very important skeptic, and that was Enrico Fermi.
Yeah, Fermi. Fermi was a little bit earlier, but he is the kind of king of the skeptics, because the story, quick story, goes that he was in Los Alamos in 1950. He was having lunch with his friends, and they were talking about one of their favorite subjects, which was these UFO reports, which are coming along. So then Fermi apparently out of nowhere said, well, if there are aliens out there, where is everybody? You know, if we do these calculations and the universe is teeming with life, the Earth has been here 4.5 billion years, they have the power to travel, you know, why haven't they come visit us? Where is the evidence? And, you know, that's called a Fermi paradox.
Okay, but two interesting bits of evidence were found, both in the mid-1970s. So tell us about what happened with the launch of Vikings 1 and 2 and Operation to Mars.
Okay, Vikings 1 and 2 went to Mars, and these Viking landers were purely to search for life. So this is 1970. 1976, there were three experiments on board. And the plan was, if we get a positive for life, three out of three, we'll say we found life. One experiment, very briefly, the experiment was to see if there were microbes in the soil. What they did was they tagged nutrients, fed it to the soil. If there were any microbes in there, they would eat the nutrients with the radioactive tags. They would respire, release the gas. We would have a detector that would see the radiation. Very simple experiment. They found 10,000 counts of radioactive molecules being produced. The background counts on Mars are about 50 or 60. This was positive for life.
Okay.
It's been redone in 2012. That's positive.
Okay. Now, there was another one. And let's introduce this other significant development by way of this. Have a listen. Right, Sean, what is that?
That is the WOW signal. Jerry Amon in 1977, 15th of August, this massive signal came in for 72 seconds and disappeared. The frequency I mentioned earlier, it was on that frequency.
That's
it was
1420
megahertz. Which was the frequency. It was exactly what they were looking for. The Earth turned. It was the Big Ear telescope, which is in the USA. Jerry, when he was going through his paper records, which it was in those days, saw this readout and put WOW into it. They've tried everything to find a replica of that. There's all kinds of theories. It's alien ships communicating. But this can't be explained by any natural source, any civilian, any military source that was in the area. To this day, Jerry Amon believes that was E.T.
Okay, if you want to find out more about it, watch Jodie Foster and contact John.
That's it.
Sean, thank you very, very much indeed. That's Sean Duke. That's it from The History Show for this evening. And listen back to discussions that we featured on our website or to e.ie/history. Tom Norton was on sound. For me, Miles Dungan, and producer Alan Turney, goodbye and thanks for listening.